Great to have you with us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Questions for her, please feel free to join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at, email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question, comment, or photo there. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
It's nice to be here. Not on my normal date, because I guess we made the million-dollar pledge drive. Yay! You had me here to try to round up funds, but people can still send money in. That's all right.
Well, yeah, they could always do that. You had a great trip.
I went to the Philippines, and I spoke at the Philippine Animal Hospital Association meeting and got to spend a few days visiting vet clinics there, as well as the way commerce is done there is the city is divided up into all these little sections. Like if you need glass, you know, like for windows and things, you go to one part of town, and need car parts, you go to another. And they have this pet section. And most of the pets there are, which is so unfortunate, are like puppy mills. I saw hundreds and hundreds of dogs in cages. And most of them are little tiny dogs. That seems to be the dogs that most owners want over there. But what I was surprised at is just how cats are not as popular as they are in this country. And we know that cats outnumber dogs as the most popular pet in the United States. And when I started bringing up things like indoor cat talks during my lectures, I kind of got these blank looks like, what? We don't know. And maybe some people do, but the majority of cats, it looks like, are indoor-outdoor cats. And yeah, the ones that I saw on the street sure didn't look very healthy.
It's too bad. Well, you have some apps that you want to talk with us about.
Well, I am now, for the last few months, an iPhone user, and I have an iPad, so I'm all into this. You know, got to find things that I can use on my phone. And I thought I'd share a couple of them that I use now that are free apps that would be helpful for pet owners as well. One that I downloaded is called the Compendium of Veterinary Products, and it's free. And what this is that I get this book that is like the size of a telephone book every year, and this is the version that I can have to look
right
things up right in my phone or on my iPad. And it's good for, you know, any Android phone as well. And the nice thing about it is that, you know, as a pet owner, if your veterinarian's prescribing something, maybe you want to look up, you know, what this drug is and, you know, how it's given. If you have any questions, anything about side effects, wonderful way of keeping educated. And as pet owners, you have to be your pet's advocate all the time. And the other one, most times when I'm on the show, I'm always bringing up, you know, which pet food's been recalled or whatever.
Right.
And there's one that's just called All Recalls, two words. And you can get recalls on everything from like kids' toys and, you know, things like that to pet foods. And so it's a nice one to keep up to date with. They are constantly, you know, updating it. And so it's very helpful for pet owners. So hopefully that helps.
All right. Well, Trevor in Jefferson has a question for you. So let's go there. Trevor, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 5-month-old Chesapeake Bay Retriever, and she's adorable as she sounds, but she seems to produce a preponderance of eye gunk, for lack of a better term, and we took her to the vet. They gave us medication, like eye drops, thinking it was conjunctivitis. And the redness in her eyes kind of went away, but the eye gunk did not. I'm wondering maybe if this is a food-related thing. Like, I've heard that certain foods maybe produce more
Colored
dogs.
Probably not food-related. We do see dogs developing food allergies, and typically those dogs are going to be itchy. They're going to be and may have some gastrointestinal signs. Usually it's not just related to the eyes. A few things. I'm glad you took your dog into your veterinarian. When we're evaluating ocular discharge in a dog, first thing I always look at is how much is there, what's the consistency of it, what's the color of it, because sometimes you can tell if it's just kind of like a gray, mucusy type material. That just may be the dog's normal stuff that it's making, and depending on eyelid conformation, some dogs have deeper set eyes. Really, like poodles are one of the more common breeds that we see this in, where they'll get a lot of eye material just kind of building up in the corner of their eye. Doesn't mean that they have eye disease. It's just kind of like us having sleepers in our eyes.
I would describe this as like a like maybe whitish yellow and sort of a goo. And I guess if you were to gather it in a spot, which is a gross thought, yeah. but I mean, it'd be like maybe about the size of a pea.
Okay.
Each eye.
So copious discharge. And the fact that it's yellow tells me that it's probably she's got some type of secondary infection. And so when we see that, if it, you know, the redness went away and then it came back again, start wondering, is there some other underlying problem there? Sometimes we will see dogs that, that have eyes that are too dry. They're not making enough tears, and that will predispose them to infections. And so you clear the infection up, and it comes right back again.
Yeah, and we got the tear duct test done, and you know she's producing tears at a above average rate.
Good, good. So she doesn't have dry eye, which is one of the things that we want to rule out. And then sometimes we have to do things like cultures to make sure that we have the right antibiotic on board and using it long enough. So going back in for the prescribed rechecks to make sure things are clearing up. And then we're looking at sometimes it takes putting some numbing drops in the eye. Dogs have this thing called the third eyelid, and there are times where we need to, especially in field dogs, they'll get stuff trapped underneath there that can be causing irritation, and it's a kind of a source of chronic infection. We'll put numbing drops in and actually evert that third eyelid and look at the underside of it for foreign bodies, or sometimes we'll see changes to indicate that we've got maybe an allergic condition going on as well. It's called a follicular conjunctivitis. We see kind of looks like cobblestone, little lymphoid tissue buildup on the underside of that third eyelid. So if that hasn't been done, it may be time to, you know, go back to your veterinarian and say, hey, look, it worked to begin with, and now it's back again. Let's jump to the next level. And it may mean, you know, just a little, you know, a little numbing drops. It can be done in an awake dog without any trouble. So
sure. There you go.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Matt in Eau Claire, we are on to you now. Hi, Matt.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
I just had a question. I have a 5-year-old puggle, and I noticed Sunday night when I got home from work, all of a sudden it seems like he's not wagging his tail. Like when he goes up and down steps, it's kind of changed his body movement.
Okay.
You know, but he still goes on walks. He's still eating and everything like that. He just seems like almost like he's depressed in a way, as far as you know, his attitude changed. But
So his tail just isn't wagging. That's what you're seeing.
You know how they sometimes have the tail of a pug where it's up in the air and semi curled. His is now kind of down, almost between its legs. It's
okay.
Not quite.
Okay. Well, a couple of things I think of when I see that, especially if it's, you know, not associated with any other symptoms, that the dog can walk fine, is urinating and defecating. You know, you're right to be looking at, is this just an emotional problem where the dog is fearful and afraid of something? And so you'd be seeing that kind of scared look on their face, and their ear position would be changed and so on. But we'll also sometimes see dogs where they, you know, dogs that end up with injuring their tail. And I call it, I mean, I don't know what the proper medical term of it is, but we call it a sprained tail. I used to have a basset hound that liked to go down the slide at our local, you know, kids' park. And he would climb up the ladder and slide down. And one time when he slid, he banged his tail and he lost his wag for a few days. Front end still worked fine. Legs worked fine. And some dogs that are swimming all the time, that are jumping in the water, they'll call it swimmer's tail, where just the, you know, jumping in, it kind of, you know, if the tail's straight out and they hit the water, bends the tail back and it kind of sprains it. But most of these dogs will regain it again. So check for sensation in your dog's tail. Make sure that it is still moving.
I've been able to, you know, kind of manipulate it and move it and bend it and things like that. The only other weird thing is I was at work longer on Sunday, and I do kennel them when I go to work.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I was normally it's like a 7-8 hour day, but I was at work for a few hours longer. And that's the only thing, because when I went to work Sunday, he was acting fine.
And it may have been that if he got his tail caught in the kennel somehow or sat on it funny, may have just caused a temporary issue. And, you know, again, this would be something you can bring up with your veterinarian, but if everything else is normal, I just ride it out for a couple of more days. They usually get better in 4, 5, 6 days.
Yeah. All right. There you go. Thanks, Matt.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Appreciate it very much. Diana in Oconomowoc. We'll give you a chance now. Hi, Diana. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question about a cat. I have a 5-year-old male tabby, and he's a rescue cat. And I was wondering if, in your opinion, you feel that animals could be emotional eaters because he's overweight.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that I've tried, you know, to get him to eat less, lose weight, I'm failing miserably.
Yeah. You know, cats have their own idea of how they like to eat. Most cats like to eat lots of little meals a day. And if we're using one of those high-octane foods that have lots of calories, they're going to be over-consuming. So one of the first things you need to do is have your veterinarian try to determine what your cat's ideal weight would be. And sometimes if this is a rescue and it's an adult cat, we're just making a good guess by saying, well, he weighs 16 pounds now, he'd probably look better as a 12-pound cat. And then we can come up with a caloric number that your kitty will need for weight loss. And that is something that then you can look at what food you're providing and provide him with that number of calories per day. It's, you know, it's kind of like Jenny Craig for people, you know, where you're given mm-hmm. your food and that's it. And because you're the one that's dishing it up, there's no chance for failure with putting out too much food unless you leave the pantry door open. The other thing is increasing the amount of exercise he's getting. And this can be difficult in an overweight cat because they're lazy and they don't want to exercise. But doing simple things like putting his food up on a table, making him maybe jump from a chair to a table to get his food, or up on a kitchen counter where he has to exercise. And instead of putting his food all in one place, hide it around the house in multiple places. Now, this works really well for single cats. Multi-cat households, that's a whole different story, and we have to come up with a different plan of attack. But you can see what I'm getting at. It's just you can't free feed. You have to put a measured amount out, lots of different places, so he has to hunt for a living. And then what you're feeding also makes a difference as well. Most veterinary nutritionists now are saying that cats for weight loss, the great majority of them seem to do better on a high-protein, low-carbohydrate diet. The Catkins diet is the joke that we make. And these are diets that you are probably not going to find in, you know, just, you know, at your local pet store. There are some that meet that need, but most of them are going to be way too high in fat. But there are some therapeutic diets that you can get from your veterinarian that meet those needs. And then, you know, we know how many calories are in a cup of it, and we send you home with a measuring cup and have you, you know, measure it out appropriately and feed him that. It's, you know, so that's, it's no different than us. Less food, more exercise,
and you're going to lose weight.
And yeah.
Well, it's funny when you said, you know, put the food in different places. I have two cats, and my other cat is normal weight, and I put his food up so Reuben can't get it, but he will jump
mm-hmm.
to get Putty's food, and if it's he feels it's time for him to eat, and I try to distract him or play with him, he will start nipping at my leg.
Yeah, very controlling, and that can happen as well. And sometimes we'll resort to doing things like self-timed feeders. They do make little, I mean, this is the degree of issue that we have in multi-cat households is I had one vet student that had the same problem that you have, a skinny cat, an overweight cat, and she ended up taking a big transparent storage bin and she bought a little dog door that she got inexpensively that has a magnetized key that the animal that you want to be able to go through the door can wear. And so she put the skinny cat's food in this bin, and that cat learned to go up to it, and the collar had the magnet attached to it, and the door would open, and the cat would go in and could eat, and all the fat cat could do was sit on the lid and look and say, I want to get that food. And so the skinny cat was able to eat all day long and nibble, but the fat cat was then meal fed. And, you know, and I think that, you know, when he starts biting at you, I would do things like carry a can of compressed air with you, something where you're not using your hands or your feet. You're not giving in to him. I bite you, you give me food. But, you know, kind of ignore that behavior and try to distract him with either throwing a toy or something like that. So hopefully
there you go.
Get him skinny. Yeah.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest here, I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I hope you will join me and our producer, Judith, for a special field trip for Wisconsin Public Radio listeners. It's Saturday, November 12th from La Crosse, and we have 10 pairs of tickets to give away to this exclusive free trip to see one of the world's great migratory bird flyways, the Mississippi River. And after the morning trip, we'll watch birds. Then we'll all enjoy a meal and lacrosse together. And all the information is posted on our Facebook page. So just go to the Larry Mealer Show. At that, and Mealer, by the way, is M-E-I-L-L-E-R. And you can enter to win a single pair of tickets by sending an email to Madison_outreach at WPR.org. You must include your phone number, mailing address, and Larry in the subject line for your entry to be valid. Emails must be received by midnight, Sunday, October 30th, to be considered. Winners will be selected at random and notified on November 1st, one entry per person. Transportation and accommodations are not included. Everything else is, including the nice lunch. So we're looking forward to it, and I hope you will go to our website and take a look there. If you didn't get the address and to how to send the email, please take a look at our website at The Larry Mealer Show. Shirley and Prentice has a question for Sandy, so let's go there. Hi, Shirley.
Hello, Larry. Thank you. My son, who lives in Texas, Austin, Texas, has adopted two neutered males. They're brothers. They're 13 months old. This is his worming program, which I just never heard of.
Uh-huh.
He feeds them each a quarter of a teaspoon of diatomaceous earth two times a day with their food.
Well, I have never heard of that either.
He's doing this since January.
And I bet the cats still have parasites.
They're happy, healthy, playful, and...
I don't know. I mean, diatomaceous earth works great for filters for swimming pools, but I don't know how well it works at cleaning out intestinal tracts. I have never heard of this. I would love to see some documented information from him if he wants to email it to me, where his source is for this information. My guess is that it's just one of those things that somebody said do it, but I'm not sure what effect this would be having on the cats. Obviously, it's not injuring them if they've been living this way for a long time. But there are very good, very safe anthelmintics, which is the real word that we use for deworming agents. And you really have to know what type of parasite the cat has, because different ones have different levels of activity. And so if you're dealing with tapeworms, you have to use one class of drugs. If you're, you know, dealing with roundworms or hookworms, another one. But there are some combination drugs that are available for cats that, you know, if we have diagnosed a parasite or are suspicious that they are parasitized, we will sometimes use drugs. Like, there's one that's called Drontal that we use for cats quite commonly. And there's another one called Profender, which is a spot-on product that gets intestinal parasites in cats, too.
I was going to ask you about that. I'm worming my cat with that, and I've forgotten. Does it get all types of worms?
It gets roundworms, hookworms, and tapeworms, which are the top, three big ones. The things that it doesn't get in cats would be Giardia, which is going to cause symptoms of you know, bloating and soft stools and so on. And then another parasite called Coccidia, which is, needs to be treated with a totally different class of drugs. So, but it does get the majority of them.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. We got a Facebook question from Peggy. My 5-year-old male beagle has had 3 episodes of blood in his urine. Each vet visit sends me home with yet another antibiotic. What could be going on, and what kind of tests can I request if there's another occurrence? He has not been neutered.
Oh, you know, that little phrase at the end, he has not been neutered, makes me start thinking of a whole lot of things. Whenever we have blood in the urine, you know, most of us automatically jump to the conclusion that there's an infection somewhere. And if it's blood in the urine, it has to come from the bladder. But in an intact dog, prostate disease is definitely way up there. And so I start worrying about things like prostatitis, prostatic cysts, and so on, that can be more prevalent in intact male dogs. And so I hope that part of the physical exam that this dog has been having, besides just, you know, having a look at the dog, is a rectal exam to evaluate how big the prostate is, if it's, in, you know, swollen, painful, or anything like that. In a beagle, you should probably be able to feel that pretty readily. If the prostate's normal, then we have to find out, why is this dog potentially having recurrent urinary tract infections? So getting, one, a urine culture done to find out what bacteria is growing. So you have to collect a sterile sample right from the bladder. So you come in with him with a full bladder. Most veterinarians collect that sample by doing a procedure called a cystocentesis, putting a little needle through the abdominal wall into the bladder and aspirating some sterile urine out. That way it can be looked at for just having a urinalysis done to see what cells are there, get it cultured, and if they're growing something and perhaps they've just had him on the wrong antibiotic, getting him on the right antibiotic, or, you know, sometimes we have to jump to the next level. Does he have a bladder stone or a tumor in his bladder or some congenital abnormality there that could be harboring infection? So then we start jumping into x-rays and ultrasound and so on. But, yeah, it's boy dogs, get that looked into because the way they're built, they can obstruct pretty easily, too. And so it's a lot more problematic from the emergency standpoint than it is in female dogs.
Let's go to Dan in Eau Claire. Dan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Seems like timing is everything. I just took my dog in to be neutered. I have a 2.5-year-old giant schnauzer, and I have a licking problem. He actually licked enough where I had to take him back in and get re-sutured.
Ooh, well, I think it's time for a party hat, okay?
Yeah, so.
Most dogs that go home from being neutered, because that, you know, that's a sensitive area back there, they can get their mouth back in that area, and once they're shaved, you know, that can be, you know, cause a little, you know, razor burn and so on, and it can be irritating. We will often send dogs home on with an e-collar, an Elizabethan collar, like one of those lampshades for their head. So yeah. I think that would be the easiest way to keep him from getting at it. If, you know, anytime you start putting ointments or whatever, check with your veterinarian, because if the incision is open or it's not healing well, that can actually delay healing in some regards.
Oh.
There are some things that taste bad that you can put on the skin, on normal skin, that your veterinarian may carry. There's one that we have at the vet school called Yuck, but it's meant for normal skin. So if the skin's irritated, you can't put it on it. So that's where I think the e-collar is probably your best bet.
Well, that's exactly why I was asking. I did get the collar.
Okay.
And, you know, I would just like there to be some times where I can take that off for a little bit so that he can drink water easily and eat his food easily.
Yeah, and I think that, but then you stand guard. And the minute he sits down to lick, you're right there. You've got a leash on him. You can redirect him and get that collar back on him.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Jen in Manitowoc next. Hi, Jen. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I have a question about my pug. She's 8 years old. And the beginning of July, she was diagnosed with having some bone spurs in the thoracic and then the lower spinal area. Her symptoms were she would scream when she and cry when she would try to move and would freeze out, you know, when she was trying to walk out.
Oh, boy.
And still, it was really in a lot of pain. He got her to the vet, who started her on a prednisone tapered down dose for about a month and a half with Robax quarter tabs for the muscles if necessary. I did not have to use a lot of the Robax. So after about a month and a half, you know, sure, it's been longer than that now, but her movement is no more freezing, no more screaming. Sometimes she does show some decreased movement. And I do have her on an herbal supplement. The vet said it was okay to use. It's called DGP.
I'm not sure what that is. Yeah.
And it's got a bunch of different extracts and things. He said if it, you know, he was willing, he's open-minded, said if it doesn't hurt, fine. If it doesn't help, you know, then you're not losing anything. But, you know, would you ever suggest, what would you suggest for treatment from now on? I mean, is this an inflammatory condition that's
Come
and go?
Yeah, typically I don't use steroids for these cases. Often we'll find that we get better results using pain medications, anti-inflammatory drugs or pain medication rather than steroids. And so, you know, for long-term management, you definitely want to have a washout period and get that steroid out of your dog's system for at least a week or more. But then talk to your veterinarian about whether it would be safe to put your dog on a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. There's many of them on the market. There's one called Meloxicam. There's Carprofen or Rimadyl. Prevacox, Deramax, lots and lots of them out there. So talk to your veterinarian about which one they feel comfortable using. There's other pain medications that work centrally that may help your dog as well. You may want to look into some other, like, additional therapeutic options, such as working with a veterinary chiropractor or acupuncture treatments, and also working with a physical therapist so that your dog can maintain their muscle mass and have that good support of their muscles around their back rather than just laying around and not doing anything because they hurt. So this is like a really kind of a multi-prong approach to dealing with chronic pain in dogs. And then there are some dogs where we're looking at surgical intervention to do, like, either like in the neck area, ventral slot, to kind of open up the so the spinal cord isn't being squashed and compressed. So there are, you know, surgeries that can be done, but these would have to be done obviously by a veterinary neurosurgeon, and most vets in practice, including me, would not even want to think about doing that kind of surgery.
There we go.
Is this something that is just going to get progressively worse? I mean, she seems pretty good now.
Yeah, and it definitely can. I mean, if she's got areas of spondylosis, which is those the bony proliferation, that means that her body's trying to stabilize some instability in her back. And, you know, sometimes those areas also indicate that we may have an infection in her disc, in that area called discospondylitis, and they can present radiographically very similar. And so this would be, again, an idea of maybe having your dog's x-rays sent to a radiologist just to get a second opinion so they can have an idea of, you know, what's going on. Is this just a process where new bone is being laid down, or is it an infectious process that's causing this? Because that's treated very, very differently with antibiotics and so on. So I think until you get, you know, an actual reason for this, it's hard for me to say where she's going to go, but, you know, obviously her body's reacting to some type of instability there, and it's not going to go away. So,
there you go.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for calling, and good luck. Appreciate your call. We had a Facebook question from Gina. We recently brought home a guinea pig, and my dad seems to think that we need a second guinea pig in order for the first one to have a friend because they're highly maternal animals. Is this true, and how big a space should two guinea pigs be happy in?
Yeah, well, guinea pigs, I mean, if you have to be careful, because if their first guinea pig is a female that is, older, their pelvis fuses, and then if they were to get pregnant, they would not be able to deliver their babies. You have to breed guinea pigs really young. So if it's a female, I'd be really hesitant about adding in a male. So you have to, one, know the sex. And then when it comes to size, boy, I don't know, the dimensions of a cage that would be suitable. But, you know, the one that my daughter had for her guinea pig, which was probably 2 feet by 3.5-4 feet wide,
okay,
was, you know, quite comfy and probably would have fit two guinea pigs quite comfortable.
Okay.
So that would be something just looking at commercially.
But just make sure you get the same sex.
They either get the same sex or, you know, and then let them meet each other so that you don't have fighting and so on, too. Yep.
Rita in Lancaster, on to you now. Hi, Rita.
Hi. I have a 7-year-old female adopted yellow lab, and I guess I should preface with, I know that labs have that wonderful behavior of getting into things. My question is, though, that since my daughter had a baby and he's around quite frequently, she seems to have been getting into a lot more trouble.
Mm-hmm.
She has learned how to open the oven door, and she's eaten like a whole apple pie and dozens of muffins, and she will even get into a magnetically locked cupboard. Mm-hmm. And eat flour and sugar. And I guess I'm worried about not only the behavior, but the effects of the different things she's been getting into.
Yeah, and I mean, there are going to be things in your kitchen that could be problematic. Things like raisins, grapes, grape juice, macadamia nuts, anything with xylitol in it. Bread dough, like uncooked bread dough, can be quite hazardous for dogs as well, as it ferments in their stomach. So, you know, it's the kitchen isn't always a safe place for dogs. And I know many, many people that have intelligent dogs that have learned how to do all those things that your dog is doing. Pulling things. I had someone in the other day that said that the dog has learned to jump. It's a small dog, but has learned to be able to get up and pull things out of the kitchen sink so she can't thaw meat in the kitchen sink anymore. I had another client whose dog learned to pull the toaster down. get it unplugged just so it could lick the crumbs out of it. And so my guess is that now that there's a baby on board, your house is going to be childproofed, not for the child at this point, but probably for the dog. And they do make oven locks. Bungee cords work sometimes to help hold the refrigerator door shut if she's learned how to do that. You know, any food containing thing has to be put out of sight and out of mind. And those, you know, magnetic locks, that's nothing for a dog. So, you know, child locks are your way to go right now. You really need to do that. I used to have two basset hounds, and I came home one time. He learned to when he jumped on the Lazy Susan, that he could get it spinning and help himself to anything. And he ate cake mixes and falafel mixes and and then was sick for many, many days after that. So I think it's time to dog-proof your kitchen. Yeah.
Good luck. Thank you very much, Rita, for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, man. Vern in Rock, Michigan. Let's go to you now. Hi, Vern.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a 13-month-old Quaker parrot, and I'm trying to get him to learn how to step up. He's very bright, very smart, inquisitive. He'll step up anywhere that I'm near him except when he's in his own cage.
Oh, welcome to the I have the same thing at my house. Ah. I have an Illigerous Macaw and a Nande Conure, Sydney and Zappa, and neither of them will step up. I mean, that cage is kind of their protective spot. And I wish I knew how to take care of that. I mean, I know that, you know, the big thing is having them out of the cage and really getting that strong, you know, step up response while they're out of the cage. So we usually practice in a bathroom, you know, up off the back of a chair. And again, I have no problem at all with my birds there. They, well, wherever they are, as long as they're not in their cage, you know, but if you try to go for them in their cage, they will try to bite you. So, one tool that I've been, I've recommended for people is instead of using your hand, train them to use like a dowel to step up on and then gradually shorten the dowel. So instead of you having your whole body leaning into the cage, you have something that's more like a perch that they can stand on. And so work outside of the cage using a dowel rather than your hand so that they're comfortable with that. And then, you know, have it be long enough that you can be standing outside of the cage and not threatening their, you know, little sanctuary. Reach in with the dowel using the same phrase, you know, step up, and practice lots of up and downs that way. And I would just be step up on it and then let them get down in the cage. And so it's in and out, up and down in the cage, and then gradually, you know, have them come closer and closer to your hand by shortening the dowel. And hopefully that'll get this under control. My birds are close to 20. I've given up.
When I travel for business, I have a local store that raises birds, so they'll keep them. And when I come back and go step up in their cage, he'll come out and step right up.
Yeah.
But it's just his own home, I guess. He's territorial.
Yeah, he's territorial in his own home. But try the dowel trick. For many people, that seems to work.
Thank you.
I will. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Vern. Hugh in Hollandale, Wisconsin, we are on to you. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I have a 4-year-old female German short hair, and she never comes in heat.
Huh.
I've been told that there's a shot you can give them to bring them into heat. I was wondering if that's true.
I don't know of a shot that you could use to stimulate them to come into heat. I'm wondering if she is cycling, but just not having overt cycles. Have you ever tried taking her to another kennel where there may be other dogs cycling?
No, I have not.
Okay. Sometimes they call that the dormitory effect. And there are many dogs that when they're in their home environment, just nothing happens. And you take them into a boarding facility or a breeding facility and there's other dogs in heat, she may start cycling there. You may want to be really paying close attention to her vulva conformation. She may just not have, you know, the typical signs that most dogs have with discharge and so on, but just watch for subtle changes in swelling of her vulva. I'd also have her looked at to make sure that she's not hypothyroid. Sometimes hormonal problems like hypothyroidism can cause a dog not to cycle too. So those would be my suggestions to start with, probably a visit to your vet, and then, you know, take it from there, and hopefully we can, you know, get this figured out for you.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Bernie in Berglund, Michigan, on to you now. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 15-year-old Torty, medium-long-haired cat with kidney disease. The kidney disease was diagnosed several years ago and seems to be effectively managed with diet and medication. Mm-hmm. Earlier this year, her face is mostly black. Earlier this year, the nose started to apparently lose fur and turn sort of pink.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got a pink swollen chin and a little bit of pink swelling between her chin and the top of her nose, so right on the front of her nose by her nostrils.
Mm-hmm.
She's also developed a little bit of what I call a snuffle, a snuffling noise sometimes when she breathes or moves. I've had her into the vet twice now, about 6 months apart, and the first diagnosis was, well, it's either acne or cancer.
Okay.
When I saw it, it looked a little bit worse recently. I took her in again to get a second opinion, and I was told, well, we can't confirm if it's cancer without doing, knocking her out and doing surgery, which is not advisable for a cat at her age and condition.
Mm-hmm.
They took a scraping of the cells and said, hey, all we saw is red blood cells.
Yeah.
And said, well, try and keep things clean in case it's acne. And I've tried soap and water, and apparently it irritates her skin so that she rubs so much that she rubbed her nose raw.
Huh. Well, acne, cats do get acne, and typically when you see acne, it's on their chin, and it looks just like our acne. You get red mm-hmm. sores, blackheads, hair loss, their chin may be swollen, but you don't see it spreading up to the nose area. And the fact that you've got a cat with a black face that's now losing pigmentation around its nose, around its upper lip, its chin, and so on, I'm concerned about two different problems. Cancer's there, and that's possibly that it could be some type of a tumor, but usually you're going to see them progress fairly quickly. There'll actually be a mass effect. It may ulcerate and cause some problems for her. I'm more concerned that this is maybe an immune-mediated disease. Cats, just like dogs and people and so on, sometimes they start recognizing their body parts as being foreign, and there is an immune problem called discoid lupus. It's very similar to kind of some of the lupus type problems that people get, but it affects the nasal plenum, the nose of the dog and cat, and sometimes their lips and so on as well. And then there's other lupus type things too that can also affect the lips and nose. And the way you diagnose it is by getting a biopsy. I tend to not look at age as a disease. That if we have a cat who's well managed with their kidney disease and we are using a quick anesthetic procedure and we maybe give her pre-treat her with some fluids to diurese her ahead of time to, keep her kidneys flushed out, keep her on fluids during the procedure, they can handle anesthesia very well. It just takes, someone who's comfortable with dealing with older kitties to be able to do it. If it is this problem called discoid lupus or one of the lupus type things, it's treated very differently. Sometimes we use things like vitamin E, niacinamide, doxycycline at lower doses is sometimes used as an antibiotic. So there's a whole host of drugs that you can use, but you really need to get a diagnosis. And, if your veterinarian can't figure it out, it may be something that you'd want to see referred. And, going to a veterinary dermatologist or perhaps an internist to have the skin or the area of the head looked at would be in your cat's best interest, because sometimes it's just a matter of eyeballing it and they say, oh yeah, we see these all the time. I can't really tell by what you're just describing over the radio, but that's what it sounds like to me.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest here. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Thank you so much for listening in. Questions, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a comment, photo, question there. An email from Julie. I have a six-year-old cat who is very scared of loud noises, won't come out if new people come over. Sometimes she comes out to see who's there. Also hates it when I have to clip her nails. We have to wrap her in a blanket and someone holds her while someone clips the nails. She hisses, hits, and wants to bite.
Oh, boy. You know, so much of this is related to back when they're really, really young kittens, what they get socialized to.
Yeah.
And so my guess is that she may have led a very sheltered life when she was young, didn't get a lot of exposure, and the critical socialization period for cats is much younger than it is for dogs. We want to have them exposed to lots of handling, lots of new people, you know, really before 7 weeks of age. And so that's sometimes before they're even adopted. So that may be part of it. I have a kitty at home that's very similar to this. Her name's Cheerio. I adopted her, about 9 years ago. She was a California street cat that I brought home, bought an airline ticket for and brought her home. But I was guessing she was probably about 6 months of age. And in the 9 years I've had her, have never done anything mean to her. She will sleep in bed with me. She'll purr and let me pet her in bed. But try touching her at any other time. Even when she's eating, she'll run away. It's sad to see that. And it's just that she just is not comfortable with it. And new people that come over, or people that come over, don't believe that I even have a cat that goes by that name because they have never seen her. When it comes to trimming nails, again, be careful that, you know, you have to approach this very slowly, where it's maybe just touching her feet, getting her comfortable with having her toes handled, maybe doing one nail, giving her some treats, you know, not making it a struggle. Because if she learns you bite, you scratch, guess what? The procedure's, you know, ends. Then you've just trained her to put up a fight to be able to have this done, and it just becomes torture for her. So start small, daily handling of the feet, desensitize her to clipping by just starting small with maybe one nail, and hopefully you won't have a cat like my cat. But my guess is that as a six-year-old, she's probably not going to change much.
Let's turn to Lisa in Brilliant. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a 3.5-year-old pit bull that I had in North Carolina, and she developed some lesions, and they turned into, at first I thought they were spider bites, and they turned into these pustules, and they looked like acne, and it started oozing white gooey stuff, and then it popped, and blood and pus came out, and then it spread like all the way around her neck.
Sounds like she's got a bacterial infection. What you're describing sounds like what we would call a pyoderma. They usually start as like a red raised welt and then progress just as you've described, turning like a pimple would on a human being, and with a head, and then it ruptures, drains, and then other follicles get affected as well, and it just spreads like that. This is pretty easy to diagnose. You can take some samples from the skin by just pushing a slide up to it, staining it, and having a look under the microscope to actually look for bacteria. Typically, the bacteria that we're dealing with in dogs is a staph infection. And so there's a select number of antibiotics that we can use. It's just not any antibiotic that we can pick. So, you know, typically, like, we wouldn't pick penicillin or ampicillin because they're very resistant to that. We'd have to go with something like usually cephalexin, or there's a human medication called Augmentin. In the veterinary world, we call it Clavamox. It happens to be one of the brand names. And so, you know, going with an antibiotic, appropriate topical therapy with shampoos may be helpful. And because it's around her neck, we'd also be looking at what else may be there that could be causing some irritation, some contact problems, such as a collar. Keeping her collar off so that that area can, you know, heal up and be comfortable, and perhaps even replacing the collar or making sure you wash it to keep it clean so we're not re-inoculating her with bacteria again.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling, Lisa. I appreciate your call. Valerie in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Val.
Hi, Sandy.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have three dogs, two of whom I've had for a while. And I typically in the wintertime when it's cold, they stay inside and just go out in our fenced backyard when I'm home to let them run around or when we go for a walk. But I've added a third dog, which is a rescued Belgian Malinois who's about a year old, and he's just a ton of energy, as you can imagine. And I'm thinking that if he is going to be inside, he's going to have to be in a crate a lot of the time because he's still quite destructive. I'm wondering about if it would be okay to get an insulated doghouse for him and have him out probably with one or the other of the other dogs on sometimes during the winter, and how to decide how cold is okay.
You know, and
because I've never done that before, and it makes me nervous, but I think he'd be happier that way.
Well, not necessarily, because you may have a dog that now is going to be looking at being bored in the backyard, digging, climbing over the fence, fence running and barking at strangers going by, barking at cars going by, you know, and so he may become more of a nuisance. And I don't like dealing with a behavior issue that, you know, he's kind of, you know, active and crazy in the house, so I'm going to just put the problem outside. Instead, address what the problem is. You've got a young, active dog that is a working breed that needs to work. And so what I would suggest is you look into doggy daycare, where he can go and play with other dogs and have a great time and be indoors and monitored and supervised so that he doesn't get into trouble. I also think it would be helpful to, you know, give him some chance at obedience, where maybe he can start learning things like agility work, where, you know, you have something that you can be doing with him. You know, lots of running. I've in the past, when I know I've had dogs that are active, have hired school students to come over and, you know, take my dogs for walks and interact and play with them when I knew I was going to be gone longer. So that would be my recommendation, rather than trying to put him outside and have him stay outside. He may not have the coat that would tolerate it either. And so, you know, getting an insulated doghouse, that way might not be a bad idea. You know, up off the ground, flap over the door, so that it's, you know, out of the wind, and you can, you know, lots of bedding and having it be insulated. You can put a thermometer in there, and you'd want to probably, you know, keep it, I don't know, 40, 45, 50 degrees with his body heat. And so keep a thermometer in there so that, you know if he's comfortable. They do make indoor outdoor thermometers so you can monitor the temperature of the doghouse in your house rather than having to go outside. They're little electronic devices. And in fact, you know, that's something I just put in my house, and it's wonderful to just sit and eat breakfast and see what the temperature is outside. But, you know, how cold can it be? It really varies with the dog. And, you know, the northern breeds can tolerate it to be much cooler, but, you know, Malinois, you know, they've got shorter hair, a little bit of undercoat, but boy, when it starts getting, you know, down below 20 degrees, I would have him out to go potty and back in again.
Okay, yeah, and during the summertime, I've had him since April. He's been out in the yard whenever the day is nice with the other two dogs, and they do great.
Okay.
Yeah. He's not a nuisance out there. And I do take them for runs off lead at least three times a week where he can just run and run. And we have done some obedience, but I don't have a ton of extra time, unfortunately, to do as much as I would like right now with him in terms of agility and stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to thinking maybe half a day when it's in the 30s, would that be okay?
Again, you're going to have to probably, you know, maybe have a neighbor come over, check on how he's doing. Is he shivering? Is he uncomfortable? You know, and that's, I think it's going to be a dog-to-dog thing. And this just, you know, comes down to one of the big things. You know, don't get a pet unless you are, you know, that you're going to be able to provide it with the needs, you know, what it needs. And I, you know, I'm glad you gave the dog a home, but if you can't provide, you know, the mental stimulation that it needs, you know, you may end up having a dog that's may not be adoptable if it's, you know, it has to be outside, and not be part of the family.
Yeah, so there you go. Thank you, Val, for calling. Appreciate your call. We have an email from Gina. My pug recently was brought to the emergency room with an infection that was actually caused by him running into something and It caused a chip in his cornea, I guess. Mm-hmm. The treatment, in addition to antibiotics, was a serum made from his own blood to help regenerate his eye cells.
Huh.
One of the procedures that was discussed was creating a third eyelid as a bandage.
Okay. Well, what he's probably done is has a corneal ulcer, trauma to the cornea, and some dogs heal very quickly with their corneal disease. My own dog that ended up, I don't know how she scratched her cornea, ended up having to have a couple of procedures done called stromal punctures and have it debrided and had a soft contact lens put in. And so sometimes you have to jump through a lot of hoops to be able to get it to heal appropriately. The big thing is going back in for rechecks to make sure that it is healing. So getting it stained, having it looked at to make sure that it is healing appropriately, putting a third eyelid flap up over top of it. We don't do that as much anymore. Contact lenses are probably used more often, just so that you can observe what's going on. When you tack the third eyelid up, you have no idea what's going on under there, and so badness could be happening, and you may find out too late. So I would rather see you, either if your veterinarian can't get under control, have a visit with a veterinary ophthalmologist. There are several in the state now that would be glad to give you and your veterinarian some advice.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She's with us until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're like me, the animals that are part of your family are important to you and you want to keep them healthy and happy. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. We're glad to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine here for the next half hour to share new information and timely advice. And whether you're maybe a lifelong pet owner or maybe you're sharing your home with animals for the first time, Sandy's really happy to answer your questions. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And don't forget to check our Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. There you'll get updates, news, and photos. And if you click like while you're there, you'll get regular updates on upcoming show topics. And I hope you'll do that. And I hope you'll stay tuned. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along, and thank you so much for listening in. It's Breast Cancer Month for humans,
and
Sandy.
It should be for dogs as well, and cats. But, I think when we are spaying dogs, we tend to promote it as birth control. And we don't bring up the fact that spaying them also definitely helps prevent breast cancer. And when you start looking at statistics in dogs, if they're spayed before they have a heat cycle, virtually never get breast cancer. And with dogs having, on average, 9 breasts, there's a good chance of, most people think that all dogs have 10, but a lot of dogs have 9 for some reason. So it's like, but that's kind of the average number. If you let them have one heat cycle, they have about a 7% chance of developing breast cancer at some point in their life. Let them have 2 heat cycles, even if they're spayed after that, it's now a 1 in 4 chance of developing breast cancer. Not all bad news, though, because about half those tumors are benign, but it's difficult to be able to tell which ones are benign and which ones are malignant without doing cytology and getting biopsies done. So I teach my clients how to do breast exams in dogs so that when the woman does it on themselves, they choose the same day to do it to their dog. And when we catch lumps and bumps in the breast tissue that are tiny, they have a much better prognosis. When they start getting bigger, then, we run into big troubles with them not being able to be successfully removed. So once they get to be about 1.5 inches around, prognosis becomes really poor, that they probably already spread. So get your dog spayed early. And even if they develop breast cancer, still get them spayed because that can reduce the recurrence rate by about 45%. So we usually like to recommend let's take that breast off as well as get them spayed at the same time. Cats, different story. 90% of them are malignant. They're almost always a fatal disease for cats. So, and you have to have cats spayed before a year of age to be able to, you know, have any saving things with that. So, yep.
There you go. Fred in Crystal Lake, Illinois has a question for you. So let's go to Fred. Hi, Fred.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Doctor, we have a 9-year-old basset hound, female. Her weight's good, loves to walk, very active. We took her to the vet a couple weeks ago, and she's got some calcium buildup around one of her discs, which probably, you know, affects her ability to get around after a long walk, and she's very stiff. The vet has put her on a supplement called Cosequin to help, you know, alleviate some of the stiffness. But I've noticed in some of the retail stores, there's other types of hip and joint medication that's obviously a lot cheaper. And I guess my question is there a real difference between Cosequin and some of the other retail products that are available?
Well, Cosequin,
to get what you pay for.
Yeah, Cosequin is one of the brand names. It's a company called Nutramax, and they make a human product called Cosamin as well. You can now get Cosequin at Target. I was at Target the other day, and I was like, oh, there it is. It's, you know, so you don't have to get it through your veterinarian. It's an over-the-counter product, and basically what Cosequin is a glucosamine chondroitin sulfate supplement. And, you know, is it going to help your dog? Maybe. Is it going to hurt your dog? No. But if your dog is painful, this is not a pain medication at all. What this is supposed to do is help keep the joints a little more limber by helping improve the quality of the joint fluid and kind of giving the joint the building blocks to repair itself. And so if your dog is sore, you may want to be looking at adding in, an anti-inflammatory after long walks. You may want to look at switching over to a joint diet, which is, you know, not only got some glucosamine in it, but also, high levels of fatty acids, which help modify the inflammatory response as well. But back to your...
Is that special food then?
Yeah, there's two on the market. One's called, maybe there's three now, but JD is one, JM is another one, and I think the Royal Canin has one out now, but you'd have to get those through your veterinarian or via prescription. But you're back to your question about, do you have to actually buy the brand name Cosequin? I was at a meeting not too long ago, and somebody was discussing this issue, and they said there is more glucosamine chondroitin sulfate sold in the United States than manufactured. So what they were meaning by that is that you may not get what's on the label. This is one of these things that doesn't have a whole lot of regulatory involvement. It's considered a nutraceutical, not a pharmaceutical. And so, when, you know, they're manufactured, you got to be careful. Now, Nutramax as a company is one of the ones that if you were to, you know, talk to human MDs and veterinarians, we can trust them. We know that you've got a high quality product there. When you start going with some of the less expensive ones, are you actually getting what's on the label? And you actually have to look at the milligrams available as well, to make sure you're getting the right level, because some of the dog over the counter dog products basically kind of wave the glucosamine past it and, you know, they can put it on their label now with glucosamine, but it may not be at therapeutic levels. When people want to save money, I tell them, to, if you don't mind buying a jar of peanut butter to get your dog to take the tablet, is instead of staying with Cosequin, which is usually like a meat flavored tablet or something like that you can get down your dog, consider switching to the human product, which is called Cosamin. And it's the same thing. It just goes down different conveyor belts. And you can get it, like if you've got a Costco membership, you can get it at Costco very inexpensively. So, yeah. But I'd be looking into maybe some other things to help your dog with her discomfort.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And David in West Allis, your turn. Hi, David.
Hey, Larry. How are you?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Sandy.
Hi.
Hey, I've got a, 18 or 19-year-old cat, Musica, who was very overweight at one time, 23, 24 pounds. And over the last 12 months has lost probably half his body weight. Now his food intake, is the same. His litter box habits are the same. He's always been a cat who drank a lot of water. I mean, I found him sleeping in his water dish already. And so he does drink a lot of water. But as of recently, his brother down because he was sick, and he's become a lot more vocal. So he runs around the house yelling all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, his habits are a little bit different. He's a lot more affectionate. He never was an affectionate cat. He's become almost a lap cat, but I'm just wondering if there's something that I should be concerned with.
Some of his behaviors may be the fact that he's now an only cat. The big concern that I have, the big thing that says you need to get him in to have him looked at is the weight loss. Probably the top things that we see causing kind of fairly significant weight loss and in cats are hyperthyroidism, where they have an overactive thyroid gland, kidney disease, and then we'll also sometimes see diabetes in cats, especially if they have a history of being overweight, and cancer would be another thing too. With your description of him being more affectionate, more vocal, and so on, I wonder if he's not hyperthyroid, because that's pretty much describes a lot of the textbook behaviors that you'll see.
Hmm.
And this is a treatable disease. In fact, one of the treatments that we've had in the past, medical management, we don't do surgery on it anymore, or radiation therapy, has now been supplemented with a nutritional management using the Hill's company has come out with a very severely iodine-restricted diet that appears to help manage these cats that are hyperthyroid. And so I think it's worthwhile to say, let's get him into the vet. Let's plan on having him go in with a full bladder. So, you know, maybe don't let him visit the litter box right before the office call. So the veterinarian can get a urine sample and get some blood work cooking on your kitty to try to figure out what's going on, because you'd hate it to be something that can be managed, have a cat that has a shorter senior life, than he would have. So,
There you go, Dave.
All right. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Kathy and Tomahawk, we're on to you now. Hi, Kath.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We have, he's two, just turned two, mixed, yellow lab mix. And we adopted him from a shelter, a rescue. He was listed as high needs, so we knew we were getting a special guy. The first 6 months of his life, he was removed and in one shelter and then actually placed in a rescue to be with people because he was so going into himself. And his special need was just extreme shyness. The day we took him home, he sat in our hallway for 8 hours just shaking, urinating.
Poor guy.
I mean, really, God would only know what happened to him, but he was totally traumatized. So flip ahead, it's a year and a half later. He has come a long way in so many ways, but he still has a lot of little idiosyncrasies. And at times, and we're semi-retired, so we have a lot of time for him, but at times he just seems so sad, or he can be in the middle of doing something really, really fun outside, you know, yard work, running, and all of a sudden his head goes down, his tail gets tucked in, he just, you know, he'll go into this mode of kind of squatting and like something's chasing him or after him, and yeah, of course there's nothing. And, it's mm-hmm. not like...
Maybe a smell or...
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like he's definitely a very fearful dog. How good of you to be giving him a home. It may not be that anything happened to him. It could be that things that should have happened didn't happen. If in his early life he was in a kennel, he didn't get a lot of exposure to new people, he was tied up in someone's backyard, he never went to doggy training classes, you know, who knows what happened in his past like that.
He was removed. At 3 months, he was removed from his original life.
Yeah.
and placed in one shelter. And then he was so going into himself, they placed him in a
So he had a really rough go of it. And sometimes that causes, for lack of a better way of describing it, permanent brain damage. I mean, and you can turn them around so much, but sometimes it's just never 100%. I have a bulldog at home named Vanna who spent most of her time in a kennel very early on. She was with somebody that showed dogs and bred dogs. And so she didn't get a lot of outside exposure to a lot of new people. And as a result, I've had her now for 6 years, and there's still, I mean, she has to, you know, run and hide and take her time getting to know new people. Again, come a long ways, but there's still going to be these little things that will trigger it. Certain sounds, certain smells, certain people even, like the height of a certain person. Males tend to be more of a problem for her than females. I don't know what's happening to your dog outside. It could be that he never saw an airplane go overhead. If in his former life, that was a problem. We're used to it all the time, so we don't even look at it as a problem. But he just sees this big structure in the sky and thinks, oh, my goodness, you know, am I, you know, going to be, you know, is that a big bird of prey that's going to come and get me? So who knows what it is? But during those situations, if you can redirect him to something else, like throwing a ball or, giving him something else that you know he's comfortable doing. Sometimes just even allowing him to have a place that he can go and survey the environment, is going to be helpful where he's not going to feel threatened. I've had a little bit of success with putting on things like a DAP collar, DAP. They sell them at pet stores and through your veterinarian. And I've had some people with dogs that have kind of these anxiety disorders even do well with something called thunderwear or a thunder shirt. I don't know if you've seen those available at pet stores, but they're kind of a wrap that you put on your dog that looks like a jacket, but it kind of swaddles them and makes them feel more comfortable. And I'm seeing more and more of my kind of shy, fearful clients, or not clients, patients come in. I don't care about the owners being shy, but yeah. And they're wearing these, and especially if they're coming in for repeated visits, the owners report that they're very happy, and you know, how much of that is the placebo effect, but you know, when you just see a dog that's, you know, normally shy in the exam room being a little more outgoing and wagging its tail, you know, that tells me something that it may be doing something. So I'd give those things a try. Before you start there jumping into medical management.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have an email from Candy with an earth-shattering question here. Actually, it's kind of a fun question. We had a discussion the other day at work. Do cats have lips? Please settle this argument.
They do.
Yeah, they do.
Cats have lips. They are different than our lips. But anatomically, sometimes I'll even have students come out and say, I think this cat's got something wrong with its lips, because they'll notice, like, on one of the lower lips, they have this little kind of circular ball of tissue where the upper canine tooth may hit, which is normal. But yeah, cats do have lips. They just are shaped differently than ours. Yeah.
Candy, I don't know where you fell on that side, what side of the argument you fell on, but there's the answer. They do have lips. And here's Arlen from Potosi with a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Arlen.
Yeah, hello. Thank you, Larry. And hello, Dr. Sanders.
Hi.
I have Boston Terriers. And we raised them, and we had a little puppy just born back in May. And she had a little cleft lip. And, of course, we couldn't sell her, so... And we couldn't get rid of her because my wife adopted her. So we raised her. Now she's 6 months old, approximately 6 months old. And she follows me all over. And as a matter of fact, they're sitting on my, I got three of them sitting in my lap right now. Am I talking with you?
Uh-huh.
But she started to scratch. And she excessively scratches her belly and her ears.
Mm-hmm.
She is losing her hair. She has, like, on her ears and stuff, and she's losing the hair now around her eyes. And she has, like, a red rash on her belly.
Oh, poor baby.
And on her back leg.
Yeah. Sounds like it's pretty generalized dermatitis. And I think, you know, again, I sound like a broken record. Get your dog into a veterinarian to have the skin looked at. It may be something as simple as a bacterial infection that's gotten out of hand that just needs some, you know, antibiotics for 3 to 4 weeks and medicated shampoo. It could be something like Demodex, which is a mite that lives in the hair follicle that all dogs get infected with, but only some dogs develop clinical signs with. It's kind of like us. Almost all of us have mites affecting our eyelashes and so on, but we're normal. But, you know, and it's just considered part of the normal flora. There are some dogs that have been born with an immune problem that will have these mites flourish in their hair follicles. They can become very itchy because of the secondary infections. There's other mites that can affect them as well. But I think this is, you know, it's time to get this puppy in and have her be evaluated because it's, you know, it sounds like she's just miserable.
Yeah, it sounds...
Yeah.
I'm starting to scratch myself here just thinking about it. Let's go to Jackie in Ingleside, Illinois. Hi, Jackie. Jackie, are you there? Oh, I think we lost her. Let's go to Lori in Minocqua. Hi, Lori.
Hi there. Thank you so much. I have a year and a half bloodhound coon mix. We got him at 7 weeks old. He was bred for bear hunting. And we assumed that if we just brought this dog into our house, we could make him a house pet. And I'm wondering if, because that was his purpose for breeding, it would have anything to do with his aggressiveness with the other dog we have.
How old is he now?
A little over a year and a half.
Is he castrated?
Yes.
He is. Okay. And what is the other dog, male or female?
Male Mastiff.
Okay. And is he neutered?
Yes.
Okay, so they're both neutered males, and they're both big dogs. And so this may be a kind of a sibling rivalry type of thing. If he is only aggressive with this particular dog, how is he outside of the home with other dogs?
He doesn't play well with anybody.
He doesn't play well with anybody. Okay. Some of that may be socialization. Some of that may just be his personality. You know, we know that dogs that are really controlling and dogs that are really fearful, when they're bred, they tend to select for producing offspring that are like that as well. So the part of this may be, you know, genetics and what he's been bred for. Some of it may be, you know, if he didn't get a lot of, like, did he go to puppy socialization classes and get to doggy daycare and get to play with lots of dogs when he was little?
He didn't do that, but I did expose him to the neighbors around me when
okay.
he was younger. Yes.
Okay. And, you know, and that's going to be enough. But the number one predictive factor for dogs, you know, not behaving well is not going to training class when they're young. And so, I think that when you're dealing with something like this where he is a big dog and he's aggressive, I worry about your safety. The safety of your, you know, any other dogs he's around, I would strongly recommend that you get some counseling from an applied animal behaviorist, somebody that can come in and actually see is he reacting this way because he's fearful and wants to just have the boogeyman leave him alone, or is he being really controlling and, you know, and that's why he's like this? There's, you know, lots of different things, and I don't know what, I can't really give you any advice without actually witnessing, you know, how he behaves with other dogs.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We were going to talk today, Sandy, about finding a vet as well, or and when you come to say you move or whatever,
yeah.
or your vet retires or whatever.
Yeah, and this is something I get asked all the time because I have, you know, owners that, you know, they're living in Madison and they're going to leave. And, you know, sometimes some of the things that I would recommend is definitely get, you know, talk to your veterinarian. They may have a colleague or somebody that they know, and so they can look that up. Another thing to look at is, are they an AHA approved hospital, American Animal Hospital Association? Doesn't say anything about the vet's bedside manner, but it does mean that they're, you know, the hospital has to meet certain physical standards so that may be one thing to look at. But nothing works better than a visit to the hospital. And, then you can talk and see, you know, how's the front desk staff? How does it smell? Is there a long wait in the waiting room? How long are the appointments? 5 minutes, 10 minutes? Is the vet willing to answer your questions on things like behavior and preventive health issues, which are really, really important things to be talking about. Does the vet have an interest in nutrition? Because that's something that many owners need help with as well. What do they do for emergencies? And who cares for the animals that are hospitalized overnight? Do they have overnight staff? So those are all good things to look at, but I think there's nothing better than a personal visit, and just setting up a wellness appointment and paying that money is a good way to see, is this a vet that I have a good rapport with? Even in my hospital, there are some people that like to see me and others that like, they want to see my colleagues because they mesh with them better. They have, and so, you know, everybody's kind of got their own different personalities that they like.
Well, I tell you what, we are about out of time here.
And I am going to be back, I think, on schedule next month.
So
I think it's November 15th, is it?
I think it's November 15th. Judith is shaking her head yes.
Yes, okay, good.
She knows better than me for sure. Sandy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
She will be back November 15th. We'll do this all over again. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Taking a look to tomorrow, we'll talk with David Drake and Jamie Knack of the Forest and Wildlife Ecology Department at UW-Madison about the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife in winter. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.